Hello, everyone. Vector Podcast is back, season three. We are wrapping up the season with some really juicy episodes. I'm sure you will love this one. I have the privilege of talking to John Berryman today. He is an ex-senior machine learning researcher who worked on GitHub Copilot. Currently, he runs his own consultancy, Actors Labs. I'm sure he will talk more about that. Welcome, John.
Good to be here. How's it going?
Awesome. I actually just picked the book of yours and the book that you and Doug Turnbull have written together. I've interviewed Doug a couple of times already on the podcast. He has a lot to say, and I've realized you've written this book together. It's my go-to source of wisdom on search. Do you still remember which chapters you covered?
Oh my gosh.
It's been a long time, I'm sure.
Like, yeah, if you told me the chapter title, I could probably say whether it was me or Doug. I did all the fun ones, Doug did all the hard ones.
I
And we both did chapter one in our own times.
mean,
We wrote that chapter twice.
I won't read maybe everything, but the search relevance problem, search under the hood, debugging relevance problem, taming tokens, basic multi-field search, how you build relevance function, relevance feedback, relevance centered enterprise. Well, that's interesting. And then semantic and personalized search. Wow. Back in
Yeah.
when was this published?
I think we published that in like 2008,
16, I see. Yeah, 2016.
16. Wow,
Yeah,
goodness me, it's been almost 10 years.
that's the version I have. So you do have semantic
Sounds
search
like
in
it's
the
the
end
only version
there.
there is.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
But yeah, John, it's a tradition to introduce yourself to our audience. What's your background? How have you got here? What are you up to?
Oh, well, I guess that's a long story. I've had a very circuitous path. I started out in aerospace engineering because I like the math. And as I got into the field, I found out that the thing that I really liked was the math and was the software. You could do anything with those. And so while everyone was kind of geeking out about satellites and stuff, I thought that was really cool. But I realized that there's a big world out there that you could address the whole thing with software and math. So I branched out and, you've got that book in your hand. My next big adventure was into search. I joined a consultancy in Charlottesville, Virginia. Worked with Doug Turnbull. Had amazing adventures, hop on planes, and I talked to Zappos shoe sales and worked with a patent office. And then I got the opportunity to write that book with Doug. So that pushed me along really far. I got the opportunity to start working for some really interesting companies. I worked for Eventbrite and built out their search and recommendation twice. And then I got a chance to parlay that into GitHub. So I went to GitHub and built out their Elasticsearch-based code search infrastructure. The old search infrastructure had, smoke coming out of it. So we came in, rebuilt the infrastructure from ground up. And after a while, I was search was fun, but I was always trying to get a little bit back towards math, towards, data science type stuff. And in about 2021, I got my chance to make the leap to data science. Joined data science at GitHub. And from there, ended up getting the opportunity, just right place, right time, to join Copilot, because that was kind of, ML machine learning type stuff. And I was in the data science group at that point. And I came on to Copilot after the research team had wrapped up. There was a research team, brilliant people from GitHub Next. They said, "Wow, look at these large language models. They're going to do amazing things. I think it's time." And they built this prototype. And then I came in on the team that was there when it was going into production. So how to get this shipped to everyone, how to start improving it, how to measure, what was working and what was not working. And then from there, I went into Copilot chat. I was working on some of those features inside the web app. And finally, I was like, well, I've got a little bit of knowledge in my head now. Time to write another book. And I connected with one of the research scientists that was on the original team, Albert Ziegler. We wrote the book Prompt Engineering for LLMs. It's about building LLM applications. And with that just published 2 weeks ago, officially published, I have started out on a new adventure yet again. I am running Arcturus Labs. I'm an indie consultant, and I'm focusing on everything large language models, prompt engineering, how to build applications, what's feasibility evaluation, stuff like that. Kind of anything you want at this point, and it's a blast.
Oh wow, fantastic journey. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. It's very it says a lot there. You will believe it or not, but I actually advertised your recent book, The Prompt Engineering, to my students on the recent course that we co-taught with my former colleagues on LLMs and generative AI. So I took the
Great.
chapter on RAG, and I thought that RAG is nothing else than prompt engineering, really.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that's a topic in and of itself. Are we going to open that can of worms?
Of course.
Sure. Yeah, RAG is an interesting thing because everyone talks about RAG as if it's its own entity, that it's a special thing. But if you like look at it, especially from my background, which has been search and then large language models, you look at RAG and it is search and then the large language models. And if you combine them both, then it's really hard to get a good understanding of what's working and what's not working. You just, you throw up the basic lane chain application, connect the data source, and I guess you just pray that it works. But really, what it breaks, if you break it down to its components, then you've got a search application and the prompt engineering large language application that it overlaps, but a lot of it's kind of downstream. And if you can look at those two chunks separately, it becomes a lot easier to debug problems. Rather than saying, the user asked this question and I got a garbage answer, you can say the user asked this question, the large language model interpreted it as this search returned these results. And maybe that's where the problem was, and you can start debugging that. And the search results got interpreted this way, and maybe you're not presenting it right to the model. So always the name of the game with probably everything we're going to talk about today is, figuring out how to take this giant black box and break it down into components and figure out what is, what's it made of and what possibly is going wrong, and put sensors there and actually debug it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in the lecture, I actually loaned code from someone. I forgot their name, but I'll make sure to link it. We've built RAG ground up without using any framework whatsoever. You did mention LangChain. That's one way of doing it for sure. But we just really built, naive KNN search and just used the model out of the box, SentenceBERT. And then I've noticed that because we did use dot product there, I've noticed that it would favor longer passages over shorter ones, right? For example, it would pull up an appendix of a AI-powered book, AI-powered search book, and that was like you could clearly see that it's missing the point. It's not able to pull up one short sentence where the answer lies. It just pulls something else remotely related. And that's exactly what you said, right? Like you need to start debugging what's going on there, and you need to start fixing on figuring out, maybe change the model, maybe change the chunking. But yeah, I agree. It felt a bit like black box, but less so when you implement it ground up, right? So you don't depend on any framework.
And when you implement it ground up, you find out that it's not all that complicated. And once you've built every piece of it, you've already seen the black box broken down to its sub pieces. It's not a black box anymore. So that's typically, since the whole industry now is sorting itself, trying to figure out what tools are useful and what tools are not going to be useful, I often advocate that people start as close to the metal as possible, because these models are actually pretty friendly, pretty fun to play with. Don't put layers on top of it that obfuscate, what's actually happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really itching to ask you more about now, like your time at GitHub. But before that, I also want to like a little bit take your take a look at your approach, how you view your career, right? So you worked on search, but then you ended up in the hottest place in the way applying LLMs, right? And you needed to convert in a way to an ML engineer. Do you view it that way? And also, if you do, how did you prepare yourself to become a machine learning researcher? Actually, not even an engineer, right? You were focusing on research aspects of things, so you needed to move the needle in the research space.
I don't know if I have a good answer for you. Like, if anyone thinks my career has been successful, which in many ways I've done all right, it's been luckily like tripping and falling uphill. Every time I fall down, it's like in the uphill direction. And I don't, I have the hand of providence. And so, what do I do with any of these crazy jumps that I make to prepare? Pretty much, I just take the jump. I think, rather than saying how I'm going to prepare for the next jump I take, I see the jump, and then I jump into it and like almost drown every single time. But by surviving, that's. So, in this particular case, yeah, the move towards AI. Researcher, I mean, there's a lot in that. There's a lot of weight in that phrase that maybe I don't necessarily feel in my own career. By being in search for so long, and by wanting to do data science for so long, I made myself, over time, pretty aware of how things work. Just the typical approach to modeling stuff. I was never taught any of this in school, but you read the right books and go through the right examples. So I have gained, I wouldn't say just an absolute comfort with any of this even now, but familiarity of being around it for a few years at this point. And then when I jumped into the large language modeling stuff, it's actually kind of interesting because it's a different type of AI expert than we've had before, and maybe an easier entrance for a lot of people. Much of my career, I have been an engineer. And really, I predominantly think of myself as having an engineering mindset. And so when you come into large language models, it's actually really approachable. You don't have to immediately know everything about what choice of models to use and like how to train and have the holdout set and evaluate. And you can just go to work and at first, at least, just experiment. And I really encourage people to do this when they're building on their own application, rather than thinking about all the evaluations and stuff up front. Don't worry, you'll get to them, but just get your hands dirty to start using the APIs and build up some intuition and, in a weird way, empathy for these large language models.
Well, this is brilliantly said. I just recently listened to the episode of Lex Friedman with the Anthropic team, so the CEO and some of the researchers there, and one of them said
That was a good
that,
one.
yeah, exactly, and one of them said that you along the lines of what you just said about empathy towards the model, that when you know where model succeeds and where it kind of fails, you learn how to prompt it, right? You know, like, which risks you will encounter, and you should be okay with those, but you don't tilt towards more risky areas, right? In the quest to succeed in some specific thing, kind of, right? So I don't know, I like that. But what is your take on LLM unpredictability compared to more, if you will, traditional programming per se, right? So, for example, when you used to write code in, I don't know, C++, Java, what have you, it was very deterministic in many ways. Maybe there have been some things non-deterministic, like runtime and so on, but still, you felt like you are in control of many things, right? With LLMs, it's different. For example, when you ask an LLM to summarize a document for you, and then you ask second time, the answer will be different. It will be, in subtle ways, it will be different. And so that also creates in my mind some issues around, okay, if I have several users accessing the same document, should they compute the summary on the fly, or should they compute it once and store it and then show the same copy to all of them, right? But that also means that if the original summary was not good enough for some reason and subsequent versions were better, I will never show those better versions, right? So like you start asking all these like multitude of questions, or am I asking the wrong questions?
It's such a challenge. And I don't, yeah, it's infuriating, right? Like, if you're used to just doing something with Python, it's going to be the exact same answer every single time. With these models, it's just like a very finicky person that keeps changing their opinion, and you ask them the same question twice, and they've forgotten what they just said because it's a new session, so they literally don't have memory of what they just said. They start over. I think we're going to see a shift in this is not going to change anytime soon. It's almost as if you've kind of plugged a fake human into the circuit. It's like it's going to be independable. That's the nature of it, and that nature is not going to change anytime soon. So I think what you're going to see is a modification in the way we build code around these things. I think the pain point is when you assume that it's going to be as predictable as the code that you're used to. But once you get over it, you realize that, okay, well, if I just literally had a human in the loop, there's like an API to connect to a human, then I have to be build a user experience that is somehow tolerant to that. And so let's see. A lot of times people are hoping, the first forays into interacting with these things, they say, here's a specification, build this code, and they expect the answer to just work. Now, that can fail in one of two big ways. One way is that it's just too complex. The model, you can do chain of thought reasoning, O1 has it built in and it's magic. And it's going to get better, but with any sufficiently large request, complex request, since you're just appending one token at a time, it's just too easy to paint yourself into a corner. So models will get better and they'll be less and less likely to paint themselves into a corner, but it'll always be the case with sufficient complexity. The other issue that you run into and why we'll never ever get there is because when I describe something, the domain of possible implementations, possible completions that match that input is so much larger than whatever I have in my head right now. And so if you have a company that's like, we're going to have like, you say the specification for code and it will just always make the code. It's like, you don't realize until the code's written what you even wanted. You don't, and then you go back and change it. You don't realize the code's written in written incorrectly, that, oh, that it's doing what I said. That's not what I meant. So what does this all mean? I think that future implementations have to do a lot to keep the user in the loop and make the experience so that the user doesn't feel like they're just shouting instructions at a thing and then hoping that it works. But the user has to be interacting with this thing and converging towards a solution. So you see this in a couple ways. One way is like with the assistant interface and Cursor. Forgive me, GitHub, for saying it, but Cursor is just a really good example here, where you feel like you're chatting with someone that is working with you to on this code. It gets into something I hope we talk about a little bit later, artifacts. There, you're having this conversation here, but you're working on these artifacts. You're working on these things, and these assistants you understand what they're looking at. Whenever they make a recommendation to change something, you understand how it's going to change your code. You are still in control as a human, say yes or no for all this stuff, and that's one way that they keep the users in the loop. The other way that we keep users in the loop, and I promise I'll shut up soon, is there's assistant type behavior, and then there's like workflows where a human isn't still in the loop, but there was a human at the beginning that designed a workflow as like a set of steps. You can't just say, look at this website and pull out all the phone numbers, all of the menu items, all of the, the structured content, and always expect it to work. Sometimes it's better to say, let's take this big thing and have a human. The human in this loop is defining all the steps that it's going to take to implement this workflow. And that way it's still, you can make something that is recoverable. You know that there's error states for some of these steps, and you can get out of them, pass it back up to a real human. But yeah, all long-winded way of saying these things are going to remain hard to predict, but the code that's built around them, I think, is going to become very tolerant of that by pulling the users into the conversation constantly.
Yeah, so you basically, if I got your idea right, is that you put the user in the driver's seat, right? And the model or whatever LLM app is still, it's kind of like an assistant, as you said, or companion, whatever you want to call it, right? But you still, I guess we are still at that point in time when we need to know exactly what we want, right, as users. And I think we also need to know how to get it out of the model, right? Because sometimes, no matter what you know, it's not somehow achievable. Maybe because you don't know how to prompt well, or you just go into the loops. I frequently go there when I, for example, chat to, I don't know, ChatGPT, or it could be any other tool, when it just keeps going and returning to the point which didn't work already. Because the alternative doesn't work now. And I'm like, okay, neither work. You like what you propose just doesn't work. What should I do? But still, I feel like I became much more productive as a, I don't write code every day, for my work anymore, but for a living. But I, when I do, I feel like I saved, I don't know, 3, 5 days of my time by using these tools. But there is still this kind of unpredictable component to it, I'll give you one example, a very specific one. So I was building like a like simple Python code, which would draw a diagram, and on the x-axis it would need to put, these values like 1, 1.5, 2, 2.5, and so on. And so the model made a mistake by rounding all these values to an integer. And so on the x-axis, all of a sudden I saw the same values, right? And the model doesn't have the reasoning component to realize that it made a mistake, or at least call it out and say, do you want it this way, or should I do it another way? I had to correct it because I knew that I needed to cast it to float. But if I didn't know programming, I wouldn't be able to do that, right? I would be stuck right there. And so that's the level, of sophistication we are in still, right? If we're talking about code completion. But I wonder what you feel about this. What do you think about code complete? You did call out Cursor as the tool you use probably more often now, but you did work on that in GitHub Copilot team. And what was your sense of its quality and like challenges around it? And in general, how did you approach that task, that research challenge?
I can speak a little bit to that. There's two ways in which I will be unsatisfactory here. One, I can't get into all the details probably, and another way is I've been gone since May, so it's I'm sure they've made some amazing changes since then. But this Copilot completions was one of the first successful applications of large language models, and outside of the pure model, ChatGPT, that was just like large language model as a large language model service. Like this was just the, I guess it was the first. So the implementation was actually fairly simplistic. Basically, we weren't using chat models at the time. Those didn't exist. We were only using completion models. Completion models, basically, I mean, your audience probably knows this, but given the top part of a document, then all the model does, and it's useful to think of the model this way, it simplifies things. All the model does is it picks the next token. What is the most likely token based on all these words before it? What's the next token? And then you append that one and you do it again and again. And so the big aha moment that happened probably in 2019, as well before my time on Copilot, was, look, I can take this top half of the code down to the function, and the answer, the completion that it makes is surprisingly good. So like maybe it's time to just wrap some sort of application around this. And then after that, everybody's learned these lessons at this point. But it's all about the context that you put around it and how you present it, so that the model can make sense of it. At the time that I started with Copilot, we were still using the completion models, and it was the context itself was 2048 tokens, I think. So just tiny, tiny, tiny window. And so a huge focus at the time was how to take all the things that we thought might be useful and squeeze it down into this tiny space, just absolutely make sure you've nailed it. Because not only do you have to fit the prompt into this 2048 tokens, but whatever the completions are, that's that they're sharing the same window. So you can move that line up and down, but it's always gonna be 2048. So the ingredients were pretty simple. The file that you're looking at is obviously the most important thing. If the file is long, which often they're longer than 2048, then the text right above the cursor is the important thing. There was some initial work with like the so-called fill-in-the-middle models, which they don't even exist anymore because all the models are so freaking smart. You don't need a specialized model for this, but you could say the prefix and the suffix, and it would do a good job about filling in the middle. So the suffix was also an important part of the context. Where do you stop this thing? And then as the models grew, as the context space grew a little bit, we could start sticking in extra things. And so you start with little bitty things. These models were not trained on these models were trained on code, but they didn't necessarily have the context around the code. So the first easy thing to stick in is you could do a shebang at the top type thing or a comment that says, here's the path for this file. And that gives the model context about where this lives in the context of everything else. A big breakthrough that Albert Ziegler, my co-author, pioneered was the neighboring tab stuff. And I think this is all common sense these days. But basically, when you as a human are using an IDE, you open up the file you're working on, but you also open up other files for reference. So, duh, why don't we, do that ourselves? And in the initial implementations of this that, probably gotten a lot better at this point, it was simple. It was like, look at the text right around the cursor and then search these files for similar text. And if in your tiny 2048 token space, if you have any room for any of these snippets, then you can chunk other stuff into the context. You have to be careful how you present that. You can't just, have random scraps of text that are like, partial function implementations, because that will prime the model to implement partial functions. Like it'll just iterate the same gross pattern that's seen above. So you do things that make it look more like code. You say, here is an interesting snippet of code from this file in the comment, so that it's still, importantly, so that it's still valid syntax at the end of it. And oh, voila, the rest is history. We came out with a really impactful product that no one had seen anything like it before, and it's certainly changed the way I code. I'm much quicker and probably dumber at the same time. Yeah, and it's been an interesting experience.
Or maybe more smart because you get to do more things, right? Like you can, I guess you
It's
can get higher to, like you can achieve larger heights and like experiment where you need to experiment, right? And not where it feels maybe more mundane. As long as the code works and like I don't know, there are no security holes in it and stuff like that, which would need to be checked separately, I guess. Anyway, that's very interesting. But to close off the loop there, like I'm just trying to understand. You said you focused on keyword search, right? So you owned the Elasticsearch sort of pipeline. Can you, if you're comfortable disclosing that, like would that index the visible code in the IDE somehow so that you can, or what was the role of that in the whole chain, the whole pipeline?
You're asking a lot of questions that don't quite seat well on my actual experience. So let me see if I can take your question and mutate it just a little bit. When I came to GitHub, I worked on code search, which was keyword lexical search for the entire code corpus. And that was really cool work. But that has since moved to that they've rebuilt the whole system yet again, and it's a really amazing engine, a proprietary engine that's effectively grep at fantastically massive scale. But that said, that code engine, the one that I built, and even the one that came after it, are not the things that are most beneficial for some of the applications that Copilot has in the editor. And they do different things for that. For example, if you're on the web app side, there are things now, and even in the ID, I'm remembering stuff from 6 months ago. They do just in time, like vector embeddings and vector sorts of stuff. Vectors are a lot better for certain types of code search where you're finding code that is about something, whereas lexical search is a lot better when you're finding code that matches this exact string. And I think everyone in code, outside of code, everyone everywhere is still kind of wrestling with this. There's no one data structure that does all that stuff ideally, and I think we were a bit wrestling with that inside Copilot as well.
Yeah, but I guess, yeah, I understood your point, and I probably missed that in your explanation that you worked on code search and not on the generation. That's why in code search you did use the Elasticsearch index. But like what I was imagining, and I'm completely clueless in this topic, is that by the virtue of LLM being trained on a bunch of code, right? Let's say open source code that you can train on license-wise, if the user is asking something that reminds the code that had been written before, wouldn't it make sense to try to find that code and kind of somehow, rag on it with LLM? Or is it completely differently how you did it?
At this point, we've moved to much. Well, it's as of May when I left, they'd moved to much larger models, and the models themselves have read not only all the code in GitHub, but also it's read the internet 5 times or something. So they read all the blog posts about code, and I mean, it's amazing, right? It's what times we live in. So whenever you're typing something and it kind of smells like something it's seen before, it doesn't necessarily need RAG to go get common motifs, common here's what you're doing, here's what I think you're doing in code right now, and it can piece code together from all the code it's ever learned from and extrapolate outside of it. But if it is, and this is me talking about how maybe I would build a Copilot. At some point, I guess you need to see if it's if the user is typing code that is so similar to code in this code base that it's worth bringing it in. And we kind of did that in a rudimentary way with the neighboring tabs. You've already got the tabs open. And that ended up being super useful. I think there's probably a de kind of a decreased efficacy. There's a word for this. Where if you're doing a RAG search over the entire code base, probably the code that you're going to find is already the code that's open in the tabs right beside them. So maybe it's useful to do that. Maybe it's not. But I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. I think code is like, as you said, it's the first a successful LLM application? Probably some companies will say, no. Dr. Books was the first successful LLM application, but I,
There were others.
or maybe it was the first successful neural search application, and then Copilot was the first LLM application, successful LLM
Think there was
application.
Plan 9. It was Plan 9.
Yeah.
There was another company that was out there actually before us, but they just didn't have quite the same. They weren't owned by Microsoft at the time. That probably helped a bit.
Yeah, budget-wise, I'm guessing. Yeah, but I still feel like it feels like magic, right? Like ChatGPT also felt magic and scary in the beginning. Like when I saw it for the first time and I saw it produce code, I thought that my job is done, even though I was not a programmer anymore by then. But I felt the existential, well, not crisis of fear that basically many of us, and especially junior developers, like probably not needed anymore. But then as I was, overcoming my fear, and I was just, no, let me try this thing. It's probably a toy. I found some, what I explained, some edge cases where it just doesn't work. It goes in loops. And so I was like, okay, it seems like another tool under my belt. So I better master it and not, walk away from it. But the code generation still feels like magic because you can explain, like you can use tap tab and like on a method signature complete something, or on the comment complete something. But you could also write natural language, right? You could say generate test cases for me or something like that, right? And it will understand it and will read your code and will reason about it and produce the test cases. I mean, that feels really magical, I have to say.
It's the time we're wandering into right now is going to feel like magic for a while until we've got to get used to the exponential. It's just going to keep going up and going up more, going up. But I've had those existential pains myself. But then I realized when I start using these new tools the way that they want me to use them, I have superpowers. I think what we're actually, you got to have the right mindset. If your mindset is like, oh, my COBOL job is over, you might be right. Your COBOL job is probably over. But if your mindset is like, oh, wow, I can do things I never could do before. I, John Berryman, put together the HTML for my website and built a React app. And this like I thought I'd have to have a PhD to do something like that. But it's amazing. And what you're seeing is an emergence of a new group of people that are they call us the AI natives, AI native development. And I've heard code composers rather than like just coders. And you have people that are technically savvy. You can't yet you have to have some ability to read code still at this point to debug some of the stuff like you were talking about. But they will shout at a screen, do this thing for me. And they have it just takes a little bit of experience to learn how to shout at the screen in the right way. You gotta, you've gotta, you still gotta have the human ability to think about how this is structured, how to modularize stuff. There is a craft to it still. But you can start building up pieces. Even if you're not technically savvy, if you've been building it chunks, when one of these pieces messes up gloriously and you've got your floating point numbers that aren't working out like your example, then at least you can say, I'm going to delete back to here. I'm going to try a different route, see if I can just bump it out of this. And often you can. And people in every walk of life are much more effective and efficient at creating. And it's, you don't get to, you don't always get to solve the nitpicky little, if you really love debugging and writing tests, I'm sorry. Like that's your days might be numbered, but if you love creating, that's I think we're approaching a new golden age and it's exponential. We're going to keep approaching new golden ages for a while.
Yeah, I think in my career, if I re can reflect a little bit, I loved creating much more for sure. But then back then, we didn't have LLMs, we didn't have Copilots. We had to do pair programming, right? And that was our Copilot.
Yeah.
And but the that notion that you just said about creativity, I think that drove much more forward than us going into the rabbit down the rabbit holes, of debugging that thing, however important that thing was. Of course you need to debug and so on and so forth, but it didn't feel like you would just feel exhausted after that, like, yeah, I fixed that bug, finally I squashed it, move on, because you want to build stuff, right? And I think, was it Dijkstra who said, if debugging is the process of finding and removing bugs, then programming must be the process of introducing bugs. And so
Yeah, that's
that's
right.
like, yeah, that's a vicious circle. You already touched on that topic a bit earlier about artifacts. I've read your blog post, which we'll definitely link in, and I got inspired by that, I have to say, because oftentimes when I go to the said applications, ChatGPT or Perplexity or what have you, and you have a longer conversation there, it is hard to then sort of trace back and think, okay, I branched here, and okay, what was my thinking again? What did I produce at that point? There is nothing to hold on to except scrolling back and forth. And that's what you brilliantly put. And I want to open, like, you basically proposed something new, I believe. I wonder if you are the creator of this, or, like, in any case, you carry this idea forward. Can you explain what do you mean by artifacts?
I will carry the idea forward. I think there is what we're seeing is some convergence around the notion that I put into my blog post. For example, with Anthropic's artifacts, so that they splash something that I think is getting at what I'm talking about. But if you dig a little bit deeper, it's not quite what I'm talking about. Whenever you're engaged in a conversation with an assistant LLM experience, they just want to chat. And so we've done good over time by giving them like tools. So now it's rather than just like being your therapist, they can go and do things for you. So that's nice. But still, when it's a linear flow, and whenever you're talking about something, it flows back into the back scroll. Most of the time, when you are getting work done, you're getting work done on something, an artifact. There is a stateful, I really wanted to call it stateful object of discourse. Because it is an object, it's stateful because it can be changed, and it's the object of the discourse. But artifacts is a much easier thing to say. But this is what we deal with. Whenever we're pair programming on something, it's me and you looking at this piece of code, and you make a recommendation about this, and I say that's good, and we go back and forth. And anything that you can imagine can be addressed like that. The situation becomes particularly poignant when every you're dealing with multiple artifacts. So if you're saying, I really like this thing over here, and I wonder how it would fit in with this thing over here, you're having, as a human, you're having to refer to more than one thing that exists outside of this linear conversation, and you're talking about how they relate to one another. And so the blog post, which I hope you guys all read, arcturuslabs.com, we'll do this again in a second, right? It gets into what I think of as an artifact. It talks about how to build a prompt so that you have space for this linear conversation, but you also draw the model's attention to a chunk at the top. Usually, you might can put it elsewhere, you might can put it at the bottom too. Haven't experimented with it, but a static chunk, which is like, here is all the things on the table that people can refer to. Each object, each artifact has importantly an ID to be referred to, and I've noticed that these models do really well with arbitrary hexadecimal IDs. So I'll just give them a random ID, but they're really good at referring to those, and not like they don't seem to hallucinate these IDs, which surprised me. But they don't. And so if you have a prompt with these artifacts at the top, and you have a system message that explains to the model how to interact with these things, then my experience is that they obey the instructions really well. They talk. Humans are used to using pronouns and names and nicknames and other pointers that refer to the real thing. And these models, having read all the human text that they could get their hands on, the internet 5 times, they also understand what you mean about using pronouns and stuff. So you can say, dear model, there's this thing called artifact. They have these IDs. When you refer to them, then use these anchors like in HTML, because they've seen a lot of those. And in the href tag, refer to it, and here's an example. And they just, I haven't done any like formal brute force testing, but in my experience with them, they just haven't gone wrong. They are comfortable referring to these things, and it provides a really slick experience, I think, for the user. The user at the end of this conversation is looking at a conversation that they don't have to scroll back up to. They're looking at artifacts on the right, and they can grab the ones they need. The artifacts themselves, the application developer, you're in charge of how you want to present these things. If it's just text, you can just make it text. But if it's like a home listing, in the background, it can really be represented by JSON. But you present the user a picture of the home and the scrollable tab and maybe a scheduling button. You can do all these rich things with artifacts that you can't do if you're just having a chit chat conversation and it's all just scrolling back into the back scroll. So I think it's a cool enough idea. I think there's some indications that it's coming into existence with Anthropic's artifact or GPT, OpenAI's Canvas. Cursor is actually implicitly doing a really good job with somehow they're doing this. So it'll come into reality, I think, at some point. It's just too
Yeah,
good of an idea.
it feels like it structures the interaction with the LLM, and it doesn't feel like you lost your time in a way that you like. It's a, like you need a summarizer for your conversation, right? To go back and like tell you what was important, right? But how does LLM know
Yeah.
what is important? You know, but you already forgot. And so if you have these artifacts, you can refer to them. But it's interesting that I think these artifacts. Can you use them? And by the way, I don't know if you can demo something quickly. I saw a demo on your website.
All right. So this is how you go to my website. This is, oh, and check this out. This website was me and like ChatGPT and Cursor just kind of hanging out, teaching me some HTML. But yeah, you go to my blog.
So
Roaming Rag
wait
is
a sec. You've
another
built this
fun.
site with an LLM, correct?
Yeah.
That's what you said.
Well, it was me and a large language model.
Of
It wasn't me
course.
just saying build a website.
Of
It was
course.
just it's gonna it's the it's what's gonna happen in our future. It was everything is gonna be a conversation
But
working on this with a large language model. But
it's a
yep.
beautiful website, I have to say. Yeah, amazing. And the
Even the
logo.
snippy little logo
Yeah.
was generated AI. Oh,
Amazing.
okay. This is ridiculous. I'm gonna take up just a little bit of your time.
It's okay. No, it's fine.
This logo right here.
Yeah.
Check out how many cool things. There's a bunch of little bits in here, and then I'm gonna give you a quiz and see if you can find the last thing hiding in this. Arcturus is a star in the northern hemisphere. It's a navigational star. It's the brightest star, and it means guardian of the bear. And so, with my cute little logo here, you've got the A, you got the bear. The A kind of serves. It looks like guardian. The bear is representative of the big hairy problem that's powerful. But I'm gonna help you out. The stars are all four pointed. It's navigational. There's one more little Easter egg in this that I didn't notice until I finished building it. I didn't design it. It just emerged. And if I'll start throwing clues. If you're a good computer scientist, especially
Oh yeah.
within
Yeah. A star
hey,
search. A star search.
you got it. You got it. You got it. Yeah, I didn't even think about it. I just thought this needs kind of a star over here. And I looked at it and it's a star, which is, optimal, near optimal navigation of the difficult domain ahead.
L
Perfect,
LLMs are
right?
good at creating Easter eggs then.
Yeah,
They challenge
apparently.
us. Yeah.
So, so anyway, sorry for the Also
No.
the stars, that
I
was
mean, these stars are amazing as well. You can just stare at them, right? And marvel. They move. They look a bit like snowflakes sometimes as well.
Yep, they do. All right, so thank you for the digression. We're looking through my blog and we're looking through cut the chit chat with artifacts. One thing I'm trying to do recently with my blog, and I hope you guys will, there's plenty of place where you can subscribe for this. I'm trying to put in plenty of examples, and here's the kind of built-in example of it working. Let's see. You know what? This we might very well edit this out, but I'm going to go down to the now you try bit right here.
Don't worry about that.
If this
Okay.
is in a naive approach, let's say that I'm building like a real estate helper assistant. I help real estate agents, and the real estate agent says, "I want to put together an email for a client about home listed on Oak Street. Can you pull the listing?" And so the thing has some tools built in. It's got a get listing tool, and so you can see all this garbage that it puts in there. And it's got this listing, but like I don't. I've got the listing. It says it's got the listing. Somehow in all this garbage, there's a listing, but I don't know what the listing's really about. And so I could ask it about it, but then it's a filter. I don't have the thing that came from the database. I have this weird filter in front of it. Can you pull an email template and draft a new email? Another tool that it has. I guess it's going to take its sweet time today.
Yeah, of course.
So it drafts an email, but oh look, I've forgotten this the do the buyer's name. So this is one version of the email that is relevant to this thing right here. But I forgot to tell you his name is Tim Searcy, and my company's name is Arcturus Real Estate. Goes back to this. And so it fills it in, and then I'm left at the end of the conversation, copy and pasting this out if this is what I want. I'm gonna paste this in the user's email and be really embarrassed when it's got this little string at the top because I've copied that out. And if I wanted to do anything else, like modify the template or do anything, it's not there for me. All right, so let's do a similar experience with this. I want to again pull out that listing for Oak Street. Oh, I have a bitch sent. Right, so in this time I'm still showing that it knows how to use tools, but every time it tries to spit out this like JSON stuff, it's actually getting substituted in with an href that points to it. And what does it point to? Well, you click on it and it automatically loads this guy right here. Now, I didn't take time to make a real pretty interface, but you can imagine this is JSON. You can make this look like anything you want to. You can make it link out to the database and do all sorts of neat stuff. All right, I'm gonna put together that email template again.
Yeah, I guess especially when you build a dedicated LLM application, right? You know what types of objects you're gonna be interacting with, and you can build a, eye candy UI around those, right? But
Yeah, a very flexible, malleable interface. The interface is whatever the user needs it to be, potentially. All right, so it's got this customized email draft. Now, I was looking here. There's no email draft here, but there is here on this side of the screen, and you can see. Unfortunately, I forgot to stick in the users' names. So, let's see. Here's the template that it used. We didn't see that in the last example. You can see how it wants to put together stuff. You can see how it actually put together stuff. And whenever I said I forgot his name, it said, "Oh, okay, I've updated that artifact for you." So you don't have like multiple versions scaling up. You just got this. And you could do even interesting things. Like I could say, this is much better if I say John Berryman right here. And that is now part of the artifact that the assistant sees. It's in that artifact section at the top of the prompt. You can have it say, "Please change my email prompt forever to say something else like this." And you can work on this and save that back to the database. It opens up a lot of possibilities for a user experience that is easier. Because when we get work done, we get work done on things, not just chit chat.
Yeah, you reason around artifacts and you work with them like as if they were physical objects almost, right? You can take away this thing with you and go proceed with your task.
Yep, you refer to them, you modify them, you use them to do things.
And you could, I'm guessing, I'm really guessing. I'm new to this topic. You could maybe even condition the model on these things, right? You could say, given this artifact, I want to do something else with it, like rewrite some parts. Would that
Yeah,
work?
I mean, this kind of the sky's the limit. It's kind of been a fun thing to think about, but you could have typed artifacts, and then when you have a certain type of artifact, you could introduce the tools. So, like, if we need to modify this artifact, we can know how to deal with it. You can have, it's kind of what I did with my next post, the roaming rag. You can have artifacts that are like accordions. They're bigger than can fit in the prompt, but you can say, here's summarized outline everything, and every piece of that summary, the model effectively can click on it and expand it. And it's just another ID in a tool, expand the section so it can read docs that are bigger than fits in its context. There's just a lot of neat things that I think you can do with artifacts as a starting point.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Don't you think that just one thought crossed my mind is that when we transitioned from static web to like web 2.0, I guess, so what was it called when you can actually modify things on the web, right? You could send a comment, you could do stuff. Now it feels like we've transitioned into the new phase when we do the same to the ideas. We like exchange ideas and we can like modify them. Prior on them, prompt with them, take away a store. So it becomes more on the concept level.
I think everything's going to get really weird going forward. I think we've been used to going to the internet and going to web pages, and even if we could interact a little bit better, it's nothing like you're about to see. I wonder if a lot of the internet experiences, they're worried about all the text going away because like we've run out of the text of the internet to train these giant models. Maybe the future of the internet is going to be replaced by just conversations. You're going to go to a place that is a sensible, starting point, but the whole website is going to become whatever reality you need it to be at the time. And I have no idea how we harvest the text out of that, train the future models. It might be crazy, but I think we're getting ready for a future we cannot possibly predict.
Yeah, and I think spam will be replaced by slop, right? I don't know if you heard of this new term.
No, I'm scared to ask.
Slop is SLOP. So it's basically an unverified output of an LLM model. So something that got produced, back to your question, you have no idea if it's true or not. You go and paste it somewhere on the web. And then LLM goes and scraps it and learns from it. So you spam the model. And so there is now a
Yes,
call out.
you have this feedback effect.
Yeah, exactly. And there is a call out that, hey, let's not spam or let's not post slop on the web because that will bite us because we are moving so
Yeah.
far ahead in the LLM.
And who is obeying that recommendation?
Exactly.
Probably
Probably no
not the
one.
companies that need content produced. Yeah.
Yeah, the moment you say don't do something, there will be a bunch of people saying, "Oh, let's try. That sounds like fun."
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then we need to invent a solution for that. Hey, Jonah, it was really exciting, and I've learned like a ton by talking to you. I feel like we can record probably like Lex Fridman style episode, 4 or 5 hours before we get exhausted. But I also wanted to give you a chance to, go on stage and sort of. And talk about your book. Why do you think everyone needs to read it? I want to read it if I get a chance to get my hands on it, hopefully soon.
Everyone needs to read it because every time I make a sale, I get one cup of coffee. So that's why everyone needs to read
Of course, yeah, that's a good reason.
it.
But then
I think
also,
I
yeah,
it's
go
go
ahead.
ahead.
No, I wanted also you to give you a chance to talk about your company because I know that feeling of starting something new on your own. You called yourself an indie consultant, right? At the same time, you have so much with you in your luggage, right? Like you, the knowledge, the experience, and so why not share it in a different way through your company? But I wanted to learn a bit more. What is your vision for the company? What do you think you will offer, like in midterm? Where do you create the value for the customers? And maybe there will be some customers listening in this podcast, hopefully.
Sure. Well, okay, let's go through both of those then. I hope everyone reads the book. I hope they enjoy it and I hope they learn from it. Working with large language models is a very different beast from what you're used to. I think, 3 years from now, everyone will be a large language model application developer because they're becoming so prevalent everywhere. So start early. Get your hands dirty, interact with these things, and my book helps kind of take, give you the training wheels at first to understand here are a bunch of the problems that you run into. Here's how a model works. There's actually a lot of good intuition in just understanding the tool that you're interacting with. Here's how to organize a prompt, and that's not always easy. You got to figure out what's all the stuff you might use, and you can't use all of it because it doesn't all fit, or because you don't want to wait for the latency. It tells you how to, fit that into a prompt. Present it to the model in a way that kind of empathetically the model is going to understand. The model is not psychic. You need to talk to the model as if you're talking to, someone that you're working with. And then towards the end of the book, it gets outside of a single prompt and it talks about, like this cool magic word we've got right now, agency, and how to build a assistant behavior with tools and how to, build a more sophisticated thinking steps with it in review of what's happened. And it talks about workflows, which is another type of agency, really, about how to take an input bunch of data, pick it apart, do the right steps to get a job done with hopefully not going off track too much. We talk a little bit about evaluation, and we wrap it up by saying, holy cow, look at the future we're going into. This is going to be amazing. So I hope you get a chance to read the book, and I hope you enjoy it. I hope it's as enjoyable to you as it was painful to me to write. And then, yes, I'm out on my own now. I'm an indie consultant at Arcturus Labs. I'm specializing in all things, just like the book, prompt engineering, large language model application development. I think we're going into a very different world as far as like how you build things. You've got to build it like we had earlier in this conversation. You've got to build these components to deal with. You've got to build that web apps to deal with these components that are very undependable. How do you make them as dependable as possible? How do you make the user experience where they trust what's happening? And that's tricky. So I offer a whole range of things from just education, going in and training companies. I like going and working with them to think through what product they're working on right now, what's their next big goal, and see, I can say, this is a great idea. This is, you're on the right track. This is not quite feasible, but we can fix it. That's the kind of product type stuff I like thinking through. And then as we get to like a longer engagement, then I just love working with these companies, especially like startups. Just sit down, pair with them, do transfer of knowledge type stuff. It's just really neat to see what people are up to. A lot of creative ideas right now. And then finally, yeah, please make sure you check out my website, ArcturusLabs.com, Arcturus-Labs.com. And I'm going to throw together a lot more blog posts like the one we demoed today. I'm trying right now to make sure every blog post has something juicy, a piece of code that actually works and you can experience the thing that was running through my mind at the time. So try it out. I'm really engaging on Twitter. Tell me what you think. And yeah, I'd like to get to know you guys too.
Yeah, amazing, amazing. And I wish you all the best with your new adventure, your new venture. And yeah, we will link everything. We will link the book, we will link your site and blogs for sure. Thanks so much for spending time with me and educating me and you know keeping up with Mike sometimes you know unobvious questions. It was really a pleasure to talk to you, and I really hope that we can record sometime soon because you seem to be cooking a lot of ideas. And you take, from what I gather, you take really practical view of things, and you've been like, and you are an engineer and researcher, and so that's very dear to my heart to see. And I can't wait to see what you come up with next.
Me too. Well, thanks so much for having me on. It's been great talking to you. So yeah, let's do this again sometime.
Yeah, thanks, John. Have a good day.
You
All
too.
right.
Excuse me too.